This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
All praise is due to Allah, and may Allah's peace and blessings be on His last Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and on all the prophets of God, and on all those who follow the path of righteousness until the last day. Before opening the floor to you all, because this is supposed to be an open session, where I'm not really supposed to be giving any kind of a talk, but just to allow you a chance to ask any questions that may pertain to the religion, principles of the religion, which you'd like to get some clarity on, which perhaps I may be able to shed some light on for you. Before doing that, I would just like to give a brief translation of what our little brother recited from the Quran. It is from the chapter known as Al-Baqarah, the second chapter of the Quran, referred to in English as the cow. And it is verse 255 from this chapter, in which Allah gives us a description of Himself and gives us a concept which is a universal concept which had always been taught by the Prophet. He clarifies in this verse misconceptions which peoples in various societies, various religions, you know, have taken and have deviated from the correct concept of God, and in doing so they ended up worshipping God's creation or making God like His creation, and in doing so they further deviated from the path, and many of them, we know, will end their lives in hell. So this verse was for the guidance of man, clarifying who God is and what is our relationship to that God. It begins by Allah saying that Allah, there is no God beside Him. That's the beginning point. He is Al-Hayy, the living God. It's not just a concept, an idea, but a living God. And a God who he does not depend on His creation in any way, shape, or form. He is completely independent from His creation. All depends on Him. That He is not overcome by tiredness or has any need for sleep. What He does with His powers in no way taxes Him. As a man gets tired from work, etc., this is not God. His dominion spreads over all of the creation. He has control of all aspects of creation. And none can intercede on the behalf of anyone else except by His permission. In other words, intercession can only be for those who God pleases or pleases God to have their intercession. In other words, the idea of intercession, because this is an area where people have gone astray, even amongst Muslims, where they feel that you may live a wretched life, but because of your love for the Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him, on the day of judgment, he is going to intercede for you, you'll get into paradise. So, actually what this is like, the concept of the chosen people. The chosen people of God, who no matter what they do, because they have a special key, they can go into paradise. But this is mistaken. That intercession of the Prophet is only... And this intercession is given not only to Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him, but to other prophets and to other righteous people. But it is only a way of showing honor to these people on the day of judgment, that Allah would allow certain people salvation by the request of these individuals. But it's only those people who God had already chose to have intercession for, that they would be among those going to paradise. So there is nobody, the Prophet or the righteous are not in a position where they can just choose any individual. This wretched person was living a horrible life. They can now decide, oh, because he loved me, I am going to ask for his intercession and God is going to intercede. No. Intercession is only by the will of God. For those people who please God, these are the people who will attain salvation of him. This is the essence of that verse. And just before also going into the open session, I'd just like to add also that when Allah says that there is no God besides him, that the concept of God in Islam is an object of worship. Whatever we take as an object of worship, whatever we submit our wills to, becomes our God. So we may have many gods. Though we speak only of one God, we may have many gods in reality, in practice. Because our will should be submitted only to God alone. And if we follow our desires, for example, God refers in the Quran saying, have you seen the one who takes his desires as his God? In other words, whatever he feels to do, he has a desire to do this, he goes and he does it. In other words, he has submitted his will to his desires. One could make money his God. He will do anything for money. That is his God now. Even though he says, I'm worshipping Allah, but he's doing anything for money. It doesn't matter, he will break rules, he will commit sins, he will lie, cheat, steal, everything for money. So this now is his God. So when we say that there is no God besides him, it means in the purest sense that we only submit our wills to God alone. And this is why, for example, even in the case of smoking, one of the reasons why smoking is prohibited amongst Muslims, prohibited, because it involves a person's will. You know that this instrument is harmful to you. The medical profession has confirmed for you that this will kill you. And it's killing hundreds, thousands every day. But you cannot give it up. What has happened? Your will, you have lost the will to decide, to do what you know to be correct. This thing has got a hold on you. Then Islam does not want you to be addicted to anything. Because addiction means you have lost the will, the ability to choose now. You have submitted yourself to this thing. And anything, it could even be your wife. If your wife, whatever she asks you, you're ready to do it. Even though, you know, Islamically or, you know, in terms of good and bad, this is not really good, but she wants you and you love her. If your love causes you to do what you know to be wrong, then you have begun to worship your wife. So, we have to be very careful, making sure that we understand what we mean when we talk about submitting our wills to God alone, worshipping one God. Okay, this is, I guess just, so, maybe this is enough, I think. Maybe I don't really need all the way up to the share. So, as I said, this was just a brief introduction, a brief thought that I wanted to clarify for you what is meant when we talk about worship and who is God, you know, and how what we may not normally consider to be a God can become a God. This is from the Islamic perspective. And from here now, I just want to go on into any questions that you may have, any points you'd like to raise or comments you'd like to make, you know, concerning different aspects of Islam.
The unbelievers. Okay. Unbelievers or disbelievers. In Arabic, the term used is kafir. Now, kafir actually means, it comes from ancient, you know, Arabic word, which actually means an individual who hides something. And specifically, the term was used to refer to a farmer. When he would dig a hole in the ground, he would put the seed and he would cover it. This act was called kafir. And the person who does it is called a kafir. He is concealing that seed in the ground. And this is the term which has been used to refer to those who do not believe. And what it is in fact saying is that everybody knows in their heart. However, people will conceal that which they know to be true. And this is also based on a principle found in the Quran, where God says that when he created Adam, he took from Adam all of his descendants and he made them bear witness that he was their Lord, and they all bore witness. And he went on to explain why he did this, so that no one could come on the day of judgment and stand before God and say, I didn't know anything about God. Nor could anyone blame their state of disbelief on their parents, on their family, on their environment. So everybody has within him knowledge of God. He may conceal it in different ways, either by denying the existence of God altogether, or by conceiving of God, worshipping God within the creation, instead of going beyond that which God has created to the Creator himself. So the term disbeliever will include not only those who claim there is no God at all, but according to the Quranic context, those who say God is one of three, and the Trinitarian concept, this is considered to be a point of disbelief, or when they say God is one of two, Zoroastrian believes in a God of good, a God of evil, you know. Okay?
You just mentioned that we're all from Adam, right? That is the case. My Bible tells me, Christianity tells me that salvation is for everyone. Since we're all from Adam, then why is there such competition between Jews and Muslims and Christianity if we all just from one, you know, from Adam? So that means we're all brothers and sisters. So why is there so much animosity between the different religions?
Well, I would say that when Jesus came and called the Jews to the correct understanding of the teachings of God, the majority rejected. So this is the beginning of the animosity. Not only did they reject, but they claimed that Jesus was a bastard. So they accused Jesus further, even, you know, of claiming that he was God and a variety of other things, that he was seeking temporal rulership of the people, and, you know, a variety of claims were raised by them. They tried to destroy him because they rejected the truth that he brought. You see, when truth comes, it just makes things clear for people who want to know the distinction between truth and falsehood. So when truth comes, there's a separation takes place. Those who are going to follow the truth and those who reject the truth. And those who reject the truth, you know, are going to be, they're going to have animosity until they can eradicate those people. You see, so that is something inevitable, something which one cannot avoid. I mean, even for a simple thing, for example, I remember back in the States sometime back, when I think it was Anita Bryant, took a position against homosexuality. And the whole forces of the society came against her. She was taking a position which is something from the Bible, which is, you know, the society which commits itself, or the Christian society, technically speaking, should have been supporting her. Instead, she was destroyed. She was devastated. Because she stood up for the truth. Instead, what you find is much of the church went along with the flow. And when I started reading writings by a number of different church leaders, you know, talking about just love. You know, they don't want to deal, because the Old Testament is very clear about how we deal with homosexuals. But now, because you're talking about gay power and gay rights and all this other stuff, you know, this modification took place. And so people started talking about just love. You know, so as long as their love is just, there's no injustice in it, it's all right. Yeah, this is nonsense. And those who stand up for the truth, now anybody, any political leader in America, for him to stand up against homosexuals, that is political suicide. It's political suicide. But it's the truth. It's the truth. So this is reality. That wherever the truth comes, the forces of evil that do not wish that truth will be opposed. So antagonism is going to be there. After Jesus' time, Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him, upon Jesus, and on all the prophets, came. And he brought the message, bringing people back to that original message, which came from Adam to Abraham to Moses, etc. Those who rejected took a position of enmity. The majority of the people, for example, of the Middle East areas of Syria, Iraq, Egypt, North Africa, these people were mostly Christians. The majority of them, when the message came to them, they accepted. Those who rejected it took a stance of enmity, as I said. And that will continue. But it states very clearly in the Quran, for example, that you will find among the Christians those who are closest to the Muslims. Though the Jews, in terms of their belief, are closer. See, you have a difference between, distinction between knowledge and actual practice. Because if you look at the monotheism which Islam upholds, and you look at what the Jews have in terms of monotheism, it's very close. The difference between the two is very fine. I mean, you really have to look in carefully to understand where the distinction came. Where is there a difference? Yet, the position of the Jews has always been, from the time of the Prophet till today, has always been, you know, great animosity towards Muslims. Though Muslims have taken them in. In Spain, when Jews were driven out of Europe, where did they go? They went to Spain. And they were protected by the Muslims in Spain. The greatest Jewish writers and scholars, they appeared during that period when they were under protection of Muslims in Spain. From there, when the Muslims were driven out of Spain, they went to North Africa, to Morocco, Algeria, etc. So though that animosity is there, the Muslims have always been open in the sense of allowing them, not, you know, pushing them away, you know, not allowing them to live within their lands, etc., etc. But that animosity, that fundamental animosity is there. Any other questions, anybody?
I have another.
Okay. Go ahead. Rumor or fact? Can we or can we not practice Christianity here in the kingdom? Can we or can we not bring our Bible into the kingdom? And if so, I mean if not, then why? And if so, then why are we so that we can't?
Well, one, in terms of practice of Christianity, in the sense of an individual worshiping God,
you know, in his own way, because it's not even just a question of Christianity. If you are Buddhist and you worship God through Buddha or whatever, nobody is going to say here you cannot worship. Private worship, in the privacy of your home, etc., nobody is going to stop you from doing so. The bringing in of the Bible, according to law, a Christian is allowed to bring in one Bible as an individual with himself. However, at the customs, you have individuals who are going according to how they feel. And if they catch you with a Bible, they're taking it away. You know, this is a contradiction between what is actually on the law book and what is happening in practice in a number of instances. You know, that is an issue which you have to take up with the, you know, governmental departments which deal with those issues, right? I can't really, you know, solve it for you in a sense. But this is actually the law, because the idea, what is really prohibited in terms of any religious practices here outside of Islamic practices is the propagation of that religion. And propagation involving the setting up of churches or synagogues or temples or whatever, the setting up of these things and the attempt to distribute literature and, you know, call people to this, this is not allowed. You personally want to practice yourself, you're allowed. You know. And this is specific for this region here, Saudi Arabia. It's specific. And this is something which was not decided upon by the Saudi government. You know, they decided this is going to be their policy. No, this was something which the Prophet Muhammad, may God peace and blessings be upon him, told his followers to do. Okay, and this is just a part of the principle of maintaining an area around the two sanctuaries of Islam, Mecca and Medina, within which no non-Muslims may enter. That the area surrounding it, to some degree, also maintains an attitude which is similar to that. But it doesn't prevent non-Muslims from entering, but not establishing the systems and propagation of it, you know. So, but when you go outside of Saudi Arabia, you go into Egypt or into any other Muslim country, it is allowed for a Christian to set up his church. If he wants to propagate, it is not going to stop him from propagating, you know. Because fundamentally, Muslims do believe that the truth is clear from falsehood, you know. That if you put things straight up and down, evidence, back on, you know, for the people to choose from, if they're not being tricked. Because there's a difference between if you come to a country where people are starving to death, you know, they need something to put in their mouth to live, and you tell them, accept Christ and you'll get this in your mouth, they say, okay, accept Christ. Okay. You see, that kind of propagation, of course, Islamic will not allow you to do this. You know, if you're going to propagate on faith, you present your evidence, we present our evidence, that the people choose. No harm. And why we believe this, you know, strongly, is that history has proven itself. That where you look in the world historically of people who have accepted Islam, you will find many Christians who were scholars of Christianity who accepted Islam. You will never find any Muslim scholar who has accepted anything other than Islam. Never. Unheard of. You can find individual ignorant people who are not aware of what Islam is and sort of become Christians or Buddhists or whatever else. It's possible. You know, no one is denying this. This takes place. It happens. But a scholar, unheard of. Not because the society will try to kill the scholar, no, but just because of the fact that the knowledge, when a person has clear knowledge of what Islam is, then they will know that that is what Jesus was actually teaching. And that is what Moses was actually teaching. So there's no way that you can now get that person to accept a teaching which was not the teachings of Jesus himself. But this is our belief. And as I said, history holds it up. You know, 2 years ago there was a round table discussion in Khartoum, or 3 years ago in Khartoum, between priests, ministers from the Christian church, and scholars from Egypt and Sudan, They discussed over a period of about 5 days. This whole discussion has been recorded. The whole discussion presenting, both sides presenting evidence. At the end of the discussion, of the seven different representatives from various denominations there in the Sudan, five out of the seven accepted Islam. That's what we believe. If Islam is put on equal footing with Christianity or any other belief, where people get a chance to see clearly what is the actual teaching, not judging Islam by people, because of course you can run into some very horrible representations of Islam here or anywhere around the world, and if you were to judge Islam by that, you know, then of course you would never be attracted in any way, shape or form. You know, just like you can find horrible examples of Christianity around the world, or horrible examples of Buddhism or whatever, you know. But really one has to go back to the teachings, and when you go back into the teachings of Christianity or in the back into the teachings of Buddhism, it calls to good. It calls to righteousness. It calls to, you know, fair dealings amongst people. I mean, this is one thing which is common in all religions.
One more question here, and then I guess somebody else can.
Okay.
Kind of a two-part here. My Bible tells me that we're supposed to pray all the time. Where you're not leaving all night, we should meditate all the time, and we should study. I hardly ever see Muslims reading the Quran, but I see them praying, you know, five times a day, and I want to know what the purpose of that is. And you mentioned earlier about worshiping idols or other gods, and when you go to worship and they pray and they bow to the
Kaaba,
what is the purpose of that?
Sure. First, the idea of worship all the time. Worship, we could say being conscious of God all the time, this is something which Islam teaches. Islam does not teach that a person is conscious of God only at those five times of prayer. This is like the minimum requirement. This is what the idea, this is like a minimum requirement, you know, like in anything, anything that you undertake, there's sort of a minimum requirement that you need to do to maintain that thing. But it's not the maximum. Maximum, there are no limits. And you find for Muslims, even before going into the toilet, you may not be aware of this, but there are prayers that are given. Even before going to the toilet, when you come out of the toilet, putting on your clothes, when you're combing your hair in front of the mirror, you know, in all the various walks of life, you know, the Prophet has given various prayers shown, you know, very short prayers. I mean, it's not that you're going to stand, you have to go to the toilet, you're going to stand there for, you know, 10, 15 minutes, right? So it's a very short, you know, prayer, which you'd be said in, you know, half a second type of situation. But it is the idea of remembering God, seeking His protection, you know, thanking Him for His blessings, you know, these type of things, which are constantly, you know, should be on a Muslim's lips, you know, as much as possible. You know, you hear Allahu Akbar, you hear Subhanallah, Alhamdulillah. This is praise be to God, which is on the lips of Muslims all the time. Inshallah, if God wills. When we talk about anything in the future, we always mention Inshallah. Of course, it's been abused to some degree, you know, where people may use Inshallah as meaning, probably not. You know, but, I mean, as it is supposed to be used, you know, it is really saying that, you know, although I plan to do something in the future, I have no control over destiny. That, you know, if it is the will of God, I will do that thing. I will try to do it to the best of my ability, but, you know, ultimately it is with God. So the idea of consciousness of God, remembering God, throughout one's day, this is something encouraged in Islam. The five times daily prayer, as I said, is the minimum requirement. And the idea behind that is to organize a man's or woman's day around the remembrance of God. So we get up in the morning, 4:30. Normally people get up in the morning, first time you get up in the morning, getting up to do what? To take your breakfast, prepare yourself to go out and deal with that material world. You know, you want to get that, the bucks in, so you have to put some food in your system so you can go and work for the man, you know. So Islam doesn't negate that aspect of life where one has to go out and work, but the first thing you should do when you get up in the morning is to remember God. If we're about God, if we're supposed to be godly people, then this is what our lives should reflect. So the first thing we do when we get up in the morning, we remember God. Then we go and eat, prepare ourselves, and go out. When we break at midday again, it's not for lunch. You know, we then put some more food in the system so you can, you know, get that machine going. No, you're breaking again to remember God. After that, okay, put some food in the system, because, see, Islam does not negate the physical needs of man. But it's just that it should be secondary to his spiritual needs.
So again, you go on into the afternoon, you know, sunset, before going to bed. This is the idea. Breaking the day down into different sections, so your day is organized around the worship of God. So that when you remember God during this point in prayer, you do not just remember Him and then forget Him till the next prayer. No. That this is supposed to help you to remember God during the period between the prayers. Because ultimately, the principle is that when one remembers God, one is righteous. When one forgets God, then one becomes unrighteous. That's the bottom line. So on the basis of that, the prayers were instituted to help organize a man's day around the worship of God to help him to attain righteousness. What was the second part of it? The Kaaba, yes. Okay, now the Kaaba, what does the Kaaba represent? The Kaaba in Mecca, this Kaaba means cube. This black object you see people prostrating around in Mecca. The Kaaba, according to Islamic Arabic tradition, when Prophet Abraham took his son Ishmael to what is referred to Paran in the Bible, which is known according to biblical scholars to be Arabia, the place where he took him was to Mecca. Hagar and Ishmael were taken to Mecca. According to the Bible, you don't hear anything more about Ishmael and Hagar. But according to Islamic tradition, Prophet Abraham would come back and visit them from time to time. This is his wife and his son. He didn't just see, this is the part of the Bible which was just deleted, you know, that information was deleted from the Bible. So you don't really hear too much anymore about Ishmael. Finished. But the point is that Abraham would go back and visit Hagar and Ishmael and spend time with them. And when Ishmael reached age puberty, got to be a young man, then the two of them built the Kaaba, which was the first house of worship dedicated to the worship of the one true God. So that is the that object that you see. It is actually a mosque. It is the first place of worship built on this earth, as we believe. So Muslims take the Kaaba as a direction for prayer, not an object of worship. It is only a unifying factor, because you see the way we pray, you know, where people stand together side by side in rows, etc. If it were for people, you know, there was not a set direction, then people would be praying in all kinds of directions. And you find it actually in the Old Testament, the Jews were told to take the Temple of Solomon as the direction of prayer, and the synagogues are faced are turned in that direction, so it becomes a direction of prayer. And you find in early Islam, in the early days, when Mecca was surrounded by idols, the Kaaba was surrounded by idols, in the early stages, Muslims prayed towards the Temple of Solomon. This is the direction of prayer. It wasn't until after coming to Medina, some years later, that in order to, because a number of the Jews, a number of them accepted Islam and a number rejected, God informed the Prophet to change the direction of prayer, to make a clear distinction between the Jews, their practice, and the true message of Moses as brought by Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessing be upon him. The direction of prayer was changed, and shortly thereafter Mecca was conquered and the idols were removed from around the Kaaba, and this became now the center for worship, or the for direction of worship for Muslims the world over. So as I said, it is a direction for worship as opposed to an object of worship. No, no, that's not what I said. As scholars
In other words, people who know the religion inside and out.
Well, my question is, is there something that prohibits a Muslim from entering into a church, a Christianity environment, or is it permissible for a non-Muslim to enter into a mosque?
Sure. A Muslim is not prohibited from going inside of a church. To go and worship in a church? Yes. Because the worship that is taking place there is considered to be idolatrous. I mean, according to Islamic view, I mean, I'm not, of course, Christians don't consider it to be idolatrous, but from the Islamic view, it is considered idolatrous. So, a Muslim would not be allowed to worship in a church unless he was forced in the sense that he had no other place to worship, to perform his worship. He would not take part in the worship, in the sense of worshiping Jesus, you know, who is worshipped in most of the churches, but he may worship in the environment out of necessity. Now, in terms of a mosque, a Christian or any person is not prohibited from entering a mosque. It is not an area which is like, you know, a hidden area which people are not allowed. Unless you are Muslim, you can enter. No, a non-Muslim can do so. And as a matter of fact, myself and a number of others have arranged tours for Americans who are visiting here, you know, Filipinos or Christians would like to see what is inside of a mosque, and have taken them in, have gone inside and observed the prayer, etc. I would advise that if you would like to go in, it's good for you to, you know, get a Saudi or one of the Muslims who are here to accompany you in, so as not to create any kind of confusion as to what you're doing there, right? In the sense that, one, if you came inside, people are going, and they're all going to prayer, they're going to assume that you are a Muslim. And they're going to be wondering, why aren't you coming and joining us in the prayer? I see something wrong here, okay? So to avoid this kind of hassle that may come out of that circumstance, it's better to come in with a person who can explain, okay, don't worry, this person has come to observe so and so and so. But it is perfectly okay. And in the Prophet's time, may God peace and blessing be upon him, non-Muslims enter this mosque. You may find ignorant Muslims, this happens, you know, because what I'm giving you is the principle of the religion, but you may find ignorant Muslims in different parts of the world. If you attempt to enter the mosque, they may stop you. But this is done out of ignorance. This is not according to Islamic teachings per se. The description of paradise and hell. The Quran is actually filled with the descriptions. If we were to try to put it in very simple terms, everything that a person desires is fulfilled in paradise. The Prophet actually explained to the believers that this world is paradise for the disbelievers and a prison for the believers. Right? For the disbelievers, they can do anything they want to do. Anything you feel like doing that nobody's going to stop you from doing, you go ahead and do it. It's your own thing, right? This is paradise for the disbeliever. But for a believer, he is limited. He cannot do whatever he feels to do, whatever pleases him. He has to go according to the bounds which have been set by God. So he imprisons himself. Not that he is actually imprisoned, but he chooses to live within certain bounds. In the next life, those who will inherit paradise, who are the true believers, who have accepted God, the one true God, and the prophets of God who were sent to them, you know, and this is not to say that only a person who knows about Prophet Muhammad, may God peace and blessing be upon him, will enter paradise. No. All of the followers of the prophets, the earlier prophets, etc., who maintain the correct teachings, have just as much a right to enter paradise as any person today who calls himself a Muslim. Practicing. So it is universal. Paradise is not restricted, you know. I know some people have the concept of the 144,000. After that, so. No more, right? No, paradise is for everybody who has truly believed, done righteousness in their life. When they come into paradise, they will have as they wish. Whatever they wish, they will have. And the Prophet explained that in paradise, there is nothing that any eye has ever seen, or any ear has ever heard, or has ever come across the mind of anyone. So it is completely different from anything that we are familiar with in this world. However, God for clarity, or to help to bring the concept of paradise closer to the understanding of man, he has described some of the things in paradise in terms of pomegranates and things like this of paradise. But the point is that it's already been clarified that it is not anything like any pomegranates of this world. The trees, you know, as God explains there, the trees, for example, you desire to have something, a fruit from a tree. Here you got to climb up the tree or get something to knock it down. Your desire, the tree's branch brings the fruit to you. This is a whole other program. I mean, we're dealing with a whole other system of things. You understand? So, the point ultimately is that we have as we desire. And furthermore, there is a further blessing of paradise, which is that the true believers there will be allowed to see God. No man sees God in this life, as is stated in the Bible as well as in the Quran. No man will see God in this life. However, those who enter paradise will receive the further blessing, or this is the ultimate, of also seeing God. In terms of hell, usually it is described in terms of the fire. But in the Quran it is explained that this fire is beyond our conception. I mean, we usually think of fire in terms of you light a match or, you know, whatever means of fire we have. But it is something beyond our perception. In fact, there is even some descriptions of the fire in the Quran which all were God refers to the fire as a creature of God, which breathes, which you can hear its breath. I mean, it is something beyond really our conception of really what this creature, this existence is. But it is some place we don't want to be. That much, you know, whatever you is the worst you can think of in this life that you would not like to experience, that's what the fire has to offer you. I mean, for more details, for more explanation, it says, you know, the Quran is filled with various descriptions of aspects, all of it trying to bring close to the human mind, you know, something, you know, of the horrors of hell and the pleasures of paradise. But ultimately, as I said, if you just put it down to the real bottom line, it is what you don't want, the worst of what you don't want in this life, that's what's coming for you in hell. And the best of what you want in this life is what's coming for you in paradise. So, it is for us to choose, do we want the paradise of this world and lose the paradise of the next? Or do we want the paradise of the next and make certain sacrifices in this world? No, it's just asking me to bring the mic closer. Fire away.
I have heard the phrase a lot that Muslims, or should I say, well, here in Saudi, that they treat their women are precious like diamonds, right? If that is so, then why do they have to wear their bias, you know, out of covers from head to toe, the veil? Why do they have to walk behind their husband? Why do most women sit in the back seat? And I just, me personally, I don't think that they're treated fairly or equal, and they're not able to sit at the same restaurant with single people. You know, I just want to know, is this tradition, culture, or is it spoken in the Quran or something else?
All right.
But you can't treat it like a diamond, then you should be treated like that.
You got a diamond. And you're going to walk the street. You know, because you brought the diamond, right? This is your example, right? You know, and I'm just saying that, you know, we know, practically speaking, that if you got a diamond, you know, you don't show it in public, you know, otherwise you're liable to lose your neck or your hand, you know, especially in the big cities late at night, you understand? You protect that diamond, okay? But, you know, having said that, right, you know, the point is that what Islam recognizes is that when men and women get together, man is stronger than woman. There are no women here, so we don't have the women's lib response. But let me clarify, right? Men tend to force or impress themselves on women. This is a natural process which takes place under all circumstances where men and women get together. So, what is the end result of this? The end result is the case which is now in the Navy, of the Navy officers, big time responsible individuals, who had a party and sent the women running a gauntlet with the men fondling the women on the way and whipping off their clothes. This is the end result. They did a survey in the Army 2 years ago, from the general, female generals to the lance corporals, and the women in one voice said they are under harassment. They are being harassed. This is reality when men and women are put together. So what Islam says is, for the protection of that woman, it is better for her to be separated from men in general and to be covered. Not that she is the source of evil, you know, because some people might misconstrue it, you know, because there is a tradition where Eve is looked at as the one who caused Adam to eat of the tree, and so, you know, she's like the source of evil, and her childbirth is, you know, pains of childbirth is punishment for the evil that she did, and, you know, and blame is put on the female. No, because according to Islamic tradition, Adam is responsible. He is the head of the family. He, first and foremost, is responsible. They both erred, but they were taught words of repentance, how to repent. They turned back to God in sincere repentance, and they were forgiven of their sins, so there was no inherited sin carrying on generation to generation. So the principle behind the covering of the woman is not because she is a source of evil, and if we don't cover up, she's going to create corruption in the society. No, it is for her protection, so that when a man deals with a woman, for example, in North America, where women, they're not, Muslim women, not covering their face mostly, they're covering everything except for their face, right, and hands. When a male deals with such a woman, they deal with her in respect. I've talked to many Americans who became Muslims and changed their dress, started to dress like what a nun, the old time nuns of the old orders. I mean, I know modern day nuns, they wear mini skirts and, you know, everything else, right? I mean, there's been some modifications that's taken place, but you have still some nuns who maintain the dress of the ancient orders, etc. And you look at that dress, you look at the Muslim dress, same thing. So now, when these women who are normally wearing the miniskirts and everything else, when they became Muslims and they now covered themselves, they found respect that they didn't have before. Men were getting out of their seats in the buses so they could sit down, giving them their way. There was a difference in treatment, a major difference in treatment. This is real. And if you have to deal with a woman and you're dealing just, you know, you can see her face, you're just talking with her, it's different from you're talking with her and you can see everything else. You know, your eyes, you're trying to talk to him, but your eyes, you know, this is reality, you know. I'm not saying everybody, you know, because of course we can say, so we have somebody who stands and says, oh no, I never do it, you know. Okay, we have exceptions, but generally speaking, this is what happens. And we can see, practically, a direct relationship between the increase in incidents of harassment and rape in the West and the unclothing of the female. This is something which no one can deny. The number of cases, according to last year's report, crossed the 100,000 mark of reported rape. And they said the number which the unreported number is probably 7 to 10 times that amount. And this is on the constant increase, year by year, and it coincides with the taking off of the woman's clothes. With the selling of your car by, you know, putting somebody in a bathing suit lying on the top. You want to buy a razor for shaving yourself, it's got to have a woman's hand holding onto your hand, you know, telling you, like, you get this razor, now you've got that woman who's holding, and everything is sold. The woman becomes an object, a sex object, who is used to sell the products of the society. She's and you look at the man. Look at the man, 1900, look at the man today. He's wearing the same clothes. He is the one in charge, and he is the one unclothing the female, and he is the one harassing the female. So we say, you know, the Islamic view is that we should protect the female. She is weaker than the male, along with the children, so they need to be protected. They're the ones who suffer ultimately when women are mixing with men freely. So the society, what it does is it sets up institutions to ensure that women do obtain education, etc., but separate and equal institutions. So you can study from kindergarten to PhD as a female within a female set of institutions. You're taught by females, you deal with females. You have female branches of the banks where you go, you only deal with females. Men are prohibited from going in there. Does that mean a man is a second class citizen? He can't go in there. The person, he can't go in there. No. It's just, this is for the benefit of the society. So if you find a situation where a woman is not allowed to go here, like you have video shop, tape shops, they have a sign there, women are not allowed in, it's because these shops are very small. People tend to be crowded in there. When a woman comes in there, you ask women who have to travel the subway in New York City, rush hour, you know, what are their experiences? Well, women are in the close circumstances, even in Thailand, for example, what they decided to do was to have separate buses for the women and separate buses for the men. Because the women were under attack. Serious attack. And this is worldwide. I read this a week ago in Hong Kong. They mentioned that 81% of the women, by the time they reach puberty, had been sexually, that wasn't puberty, age of 16, had been sexually harassed. 81% of the women. So, I mean, this is something which, as I said, given a similar situation here, the same thing would happen. It is not to say Muslims are so, no. If you don't provide the means of protection, then this is going to happen to the women. So for the sake of that protection of the women, this system of covering the woman, you know, having separation, which begins actually from the point of worship. When you're going to the mosque, you'll find that the women will be praying separate from the men. In the earlier times, especially in some of the mosques, you'll see women will be praying in the back. Women, men are in the front. Because in prayer, men stand side by side, shoulder to shoulder. And you see, you observe that they end up bowing and they end up making prostration. So now if you're having a female standing next to you, side by side, female in front of you, bowing over, making prostration, I mean, you're supposed to be worshipping and concentrating on God. And that circumstance is not going to help you. So in order to help you concentrate on God, the women are separated out and they pray separately. And from that point of worship, you know, it spreads into other aspects of the society, you know. And even, for example, the issue, I know some people advise to me, like the women are riding in the back of the bus. They say, well, you know, because when you think of the back of the bus from American tradition, it means second-class oppression, second-class citizen oppression. But here, actually, when buses were first introduced, women rode in the front of the bus. They put the portion for them in the front of the bus. But the men had to pass through the front, and they found that even though they separated them, with the men passing through, they were being harassed. So they said the best thing, put them in the back with a completely separate section where they didn't have to go through the women, through the men, or the men have to pass through them to protect them. They put them in the back. And when we look, for example, at the mother in Islam, female, a woman, the mother is highly respected. The Prophet, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him, when he was asked by his companion, you know, who do we owe the most duty to, our mothers or our fathers? He said, the mothers. And they asked again, he said, the mothers. And he insisted on the mothers before going on to the fathers. So the mother is held very high in the society. The mother is looked after. If a woman, for example, is divorced, she is taken back in by her family. She's not left out on her own to fend for herself. So you'll not find any divorced women here living off by themselves. No, they are brought back in within the family, except on unusual circumstances where family is no longer available, they've left the country, or people have died or something like this, where the state may step in to help, you know, her in her welfare. However, generally speaking, the responsibility of looking after females, whether mother, wife, or daughter, is the responsibility of the males in the society. A woman, for her to get married, she should have a guardian. A guardian to look out for her welfare, not to decide for her who she should marry. You know, I want you to marry this person. No, but to look out for her welfare. I would suggest that this person is good. You check this person out. If you don't like him, it's your choice. But if you want to marry so-and-so and I checked him out and found him to be a dangerous individual, please, don't marry him. You know? So a guardian is there so that when men and women get together, because it's very easy, you know, for a man to impress a woman, you know, She runs a few lines on her, all of a sudden, you know, she is submitting her. She wants to marry this man. She doesn't really know about him. She doesn't tend to have, in general, the kind of calculated approach to analyzing marriage. She tends to be more from an emotional point of view. God created her that way, because she's the one that bears the child, and that emotion for looking after the child, it needs to be concentrated in her. The man, and he tends to be colder in terms of his dealing with the child. I mean, he can hit the child, no, don't hit her. She'll hit him when she explodes, usually. And when she can't take it anymore, he's done it, until she's reached the end, then she hits him. But normally, she doesn't want to hit him. But the man, he can see, no, he needs to be hit regularly, you know. So he knows that he's not supposed to do it, you know. I mean, regular in the sense that, I mean, you don't want to show the child inconsistency. You know, if you tell him this is wrong, you do it, you're going to get hit. Then you need to hit him. I mean, not the kind of hit that you're going to be breaking arms and all this kind of thing, but you need to hit him. So he knows. And he shouldn't, because what he learns from mom is just avoid mom when she gets angry. He's not really learning discipline in that sense. He's learning, avoid mom when you see she's ready to explode, get out of dodge, right? Go someplace else. Whereas, systematic dealing with the child, when the child does wrong, you know, you deal with them the same way each time. I mean, this tends to come from the man. The woman tends to be more compassionate and more emotional. So, because of that, it tends to impair judgment. So this is why the system of guardianship is there for any female. And when she travels abroad, also a male, one of her male close relatives, should be with her for her protection. When she goes on Hajj even, you know, because you say, okay, well, Hajj is the first, people going Hajj, the pilgrimage, once a year to Mecca, people are going there for the worship of God. Why would she need a guardian there? As I said, human beings are human beings. You have people, no matter what they know to be right, who are bent on committing wrong. So when a woman is there in a situation where there are a lot of men, you know, a lot of women there, but she's nobody there to protect her, she may get harmed. So Islam institutes that even for her to go and make that pilgrimage, she should have a male relative, husband, close relative along with her, for her protection. Okay.
I briefly went through the paper today and I saw an article about what the difference between an angel and a jinn, or are they one in the same?
From the Islamic theological point of view, there are three orders of spiritual beings: the human spirit, the angels, and the jinn. Now, the human being has a choice between good and evil. As a spiritual being, he also has a physical aspect that we see. We're a mixture of both physical and spiritual. The angel is a being, spiritual being, who cannot disobey the commandments of God. He has no choice. Or it has no choice. It is neither male nor female. It has no choice. It obeys the commandments of God. Carries revelation, does, you know, Gabriel, etc. Although we tend to use the term he and so, the angels, in terms, actually strict Islamic terms, they are neither male nor female. Similarly, God, though we may use the term he, we do not really conceive of God in terms of male or female. God is neither male nor female. The jinn represent a third order of being, spiritual beings, who have been given the power of choice between good and evil also. However, they are on a lower level than that of mankind. But though they are on a lower level, they have been given certain powers which are greater than human beings, what we may call superhuman or supernatural powers they have. Part of it involves, some of them are able to become visible, to take human form, and they do, the evil ones amongst them, of whom Satan is looked at as being the leader of evil. He was, according to Islamic teaching mentioned in the Quran, given a status due to knowledge which was given to him, etc., which put him amongst the angels. After God created Adam, because the jinn and the angels were created before Adam, mankind, they were told to bow before Adam in recognition of his superiority. The angels, as recorded in the Quran, all bowed, and Satan refused. At that point, he became cursed. He was sent away from the mercy of God, and he became a source of evil down through the generations. His intent, as is explained in the Quran, is to try to pull all people off the path, to deviate, to disobey God as he did. And this is the nature of an evil person. You know, he doesn't feel satisfied unless you're doing it along with him. Come on. You know, people who are evil, you know, they feel good when there are other people who are joining them in evil. They try to pull them into whatever they're doing. And this is the role that he has played. Among the jinn are those who have chosen evil, so they become like devils among the jinn. Not all are in that state. Others are believers, who we believe also will inherit paradise along with the believers amongst human beings. And you may have devils amongst mankind. You know, in other words, those who submit their will to Satan or follow the path of Satan, they become devils among mankind, calling people to evil. And I just like to clarify this in terms of the North American circumstance, where you have Elijah Muhammad and Farrakhan, who have taught and continue to teach that white people are devils and black people are gods. And this has nothing to do with Islam at all. Elijah Muhammad, Farrakhan are not Muslims. They may call themselves Muslims, may have called themselves Muslims, but this has nothing to do with Islam. Elijah Muhammad claimed prophethood. We believe that Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him, was the last of the prophets, none to come after him. He claimed that his teacher was God incarnate. We do not believe in any way, shape or form that God becomes man. Incarnate meaning becoming man. So that group is not recognized within the body of Islam at all. Malcolm X, who a few months before his assassination went to Mecca and performed Hajj, came back a true Muslim, accepting the true teaching. And shortly thereafter he was killed. But Elijah, Farrakhan, and those who uphold those teachings are considered outside of the fold of Islam. Because a human being may be considered, according to Islamic teachings, a devil, regardless of his color or his race. As long as he chooses to call people to evil, he chooses a path of evil, then he becomes a devil. And that choice knows no bounds of religion, race, color. I just wanted to clarify that point.
Every time I say to my brother Arab that I'm Muslim, sometimes they ask me, how long have you been Muslim? Is there a difference between the new Muslim and the old Muslim?
Okay.
Come on.
Okay. There is a tendency of the people here, because the majority of people here who are Muslims are Arabs, right? When they meet somebody who is not an Arab who says they are Muslim, they tend to assume that they probably converted to Islam. I mean, this is just a natural assumption that they make. Of course, old or new really has no value in Islam. A new Muslim may be far superior to a quote-unquote old Muslim. I mean, what makes a distinction, as explained in the Quran, is piety. The one who fears God the most is the one who is better. Other than that, old or new, it makes no difference. The only thing is that if a person finds out, for example, you recently accepted Islam, they may try to help you. They assume you recently accepted Islam, what can I do to help you? So oftentimes they're asking, not thinking that you're inferior or anything, but that you, if you are a new Muslim, there may be something I can do to help you in understanding Islam, in your practice of Islam, the teachings of Islam, you may need to learn something, so how can I help you? Right? So give them the benefit of the doubt that this is the intent behind the question, and this is what I found out, you know, oftentimes. And I mean, I even found it, for example, when I first came over here to study. I studied in Medina, did my BA in Islamic Studies from Medina. You know, that when I met people and in Medina, and They asked me, where are you from? And I told them, I'm from America. They said, Muslim? From America? How could that be? I mean, is this something that was sort of inconceivable on their part? You know, how could you be a Muslim from America? No, Americans are not Muslims. Well, this is the general this is the general understanding that people tend to have. So it becomes quite a shock to them. Quite, not that they're doubting you, saying, no, you're not really American, you are, or you're not really Muslim. Or no, it's just the shock, the surprise, because it's something unusual. And, you know, people express this kind of shock in these fashions. So, you know, we have to learn, in a sense, for us, new Muslims, we call those who've converted to Islam or from other countries, you know, to be tolerant, you know, tolerant of these questions, try to give the benefit of the doubt to those asking them, but their intention is good intention, you know. Okay?
Prophet of God went to Jesus and Moses, but he stood and met a man. Let the people believe what they are praying for. How about Prophet Muhammad?
Well, Prophet, you know, what we have to, when we're looking at miracles, we have to make a distinction between the miracles of the time and the miracle for all time. Prophets were given miracles basically to show the people to whom they were sent that they were prophets of God. Okay? That you said, this is basic principle. And this is how we understand, for example, the virgin birth of Christ. That this was a miracle of God. Not only do we believe in the virgin birth, but also that Jesus, at the time of his birth, spoke to the people, telling them that his mother Mary was not an unchaste woman, that he was a prophet of God, and that she was a pure woman. He defended his mother. This is a miracle. Speaking, you know, when you're one day old, this is something we don't experience. Okay? This was a miracle. This was part of the miracle given to Jesus to show the people that he was a prophet of God. Similarly, there were similar miracles given to Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessing be upon him, and on Jesus and all the prophets, which showed the people to whom he was sent that he was a prophet of God. Among them was the splitting of the moon, which took place in Mecca, before the eyes of the people of Mecca, the pagans. God caused the moon to split into two parts before their eyes. One going on one side of from the east and one to the west, and then rejoining. This is a miracle. On occasion when the Prophet Muhammad, may Allah peace and blessing be upon him, and his companions were out in the desert and they ran short of water, he asked for a bowl to be brought. And water flowed from between his fingers, filled the bowl, which was sufficient for the people to drink it. Another occasion, he passed by a woman who had a goat or sheep, and he asked for some milk, and she explained that the animal had no milk, so he asked for the animal to be brought. He rubbed his hand on the udder of the goat or sheep, I can't remember which one it was, and it became full with milk. He was able to drink from it, feed it to the companions that were with him, and give milk back to the woman. And there were other individual miracles which took place. But because Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him, was to be the prophet for all time, he also was given a miracle which not only demonstrated to the people of his time that he was a prophet, but one which would stand for all time. Because if I were asked to believe that Jesus made the dead walk, come back to life, or that Moses split the Red Sea, or that the moon was split before Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of them, this is something of, you know, either you believe it or you don't. There's no evidence that I can bring to prove to you that the moon was split, that the dead came back to life, or that the Red Sea was split. So these miracles were limited in effect to the people of the time. But because Prophet Muhammad, May Allah's peace and blessings be upon him, was sent for all time. As I said, he had another miracle which was given to him by God, which would last for all time. And that miracle was the Quran. A book of revelation which was preserved in its text as no book has ever been preserved before, without any changes, interpolations or deletions or anything. Compared, you can compare the earliest manuscripts of the Quran, things were written within a few years after it was first written up, found in Tashkent, in Turkey, in Egypt, in the Library of Congress, where they have portions of early manuscripts of the Quran. You won't find any difference. There's only one Arabic Quran. And the Quran had in it a challenge, that whoever does not believe that this is a book from God should produce one chapter like it. And the smallest chapter in the Quran is 3 verses in the end of the Quran. So we're not talking about something which is really major, something which is quite small. This challenge was never met. And believe me, there was need to meet the challenge, because sometimes you can make a challenge which nobody is going to meet. You know, Elijah had made this claim also. Elijah said at one point, I dare any white man to prove to me that he is not a devil. And no white American got up to prove that he wasn't a devil. They said, ah, there's the evidence. They are devils. This was a claim which was so ridiculous, it was not necessary for anybody to get up to prove that claim. However, in the case of the claim that the Quran was inimitable, could not be imitated by anyone, there was a need to meet this challenge. Because from when the Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him, came with the message of Islam, calling people to the belief in one God again, without any intermediaries, his call challenged the whole existence of Meccan Arabian society at the time, specifically for the Meccan. Because Mecca was the center not only of idolatry for Arabia, it was the center of commerce. People coming for pilgrimage would bring goods, and they were exchanged. Also goods traveling from the south, from Yemen up to the north, would pass through there. They were the middlemen of trade in Arabia, and they were living very well, very comfortably, quite rich. So when you were now saying to destroy all of these idols, you are threatening the whole economics of that society. So they wanted to stop him. And they tried. They tried first by talking to his uncle, getting him to try to talk to him to get him to stop it. Finally, they got together and they said, listen, Muhammad, if you want wealth, we will gather a portion of all of our wealth and make you the richest man in Mecca. If it's women you want, we'll get the most beautiful of our women, you can have them. They offered him whatever they thought of this temporal world would could attract a man, you know, to get him to give up such a mission. They offered it to him, and he refused. After that, they boycotted himself and his family, the tribe that he belonged to, the tribe of Hashim. They were boycotted for over two years. Boycotted, they tried to starve them to death. The Muslims, the early Muslims and his family there, they began to eat, you know, leaves of trees, eating insects, tried to stay alive. But eventually, the boycott was lifted. They were not able to stop the Prophet from his mission. In the end, they felt the only thing left was to kill him. And what they did, in order to try to protect themselves, they took individuals from each of the major tribes. They said, we'll get one young man from each of our tribes, and they would together go and kill him together, sharing his killing. Because if one from one tribe killed him, then his tribe, Hashim, would be at war with his tribe until God knows when. So, to avoid ending up in a tribal warfare, they said, okay, if we all take part, then the tribe of Hashim could not fight us all. So they made this plot, this plan, they attempted to put it into practice. God informed the Prophet that it was time to leave Mecca. He left before they were able to implement it. He had been invited by people of Medina to come there, but he did not leave Mecca until God gave him the command to go. He went there, and after he got there, the Meccans were not satisfied. They sent their armies from Mecca to Medina to try to kill him, to stop him, stop this thing from spreading. They eventually were defeated. Mecca was taken, all of Arabia was taken. If, instead of going through all those changes, losing all the lives in the battles which took place between Muslims and the pagans, all they had to do was to produce these three verses, surely, to prove that this was false that he brought, they would have done so. And they tried. Their explanation, because again, when a person doesn't want to see the truth, even if you put it in front of him in bold writing, he's going to read it differently. Right? So what they said, Muhammad is a magician. His Quran is magic. So whenever you hear him reciting, put your fingers in your ears to protect yourself. And this is what they did. But it didn't stop ultimately the spread of Islam. And this is the fundamental miracle of the Quran, that it is a literary miracle. It has within it a quality which makes it possible to be memorized, all of it, from cover to cover. Its total length, though when you see it in the Arabic English translation, it's looking kind of thick, like a pretty big book. But if you take out all the English, it drops down to the size of the New Testament. You just took the New Testament out of the Bible, it's about the same size. You have Muslims, hundreds of thousands of Muslims, through the ages have memorized the Quran from cover to cover. This little boy who read from the Quran from his memory is involved in a program in a Quranic school which will teach him, by the time he graduates, he will have memorized the whole Quran from cover to cover. And it's not something which is particular to people here. I have a good friend from Philadelphia who was studying with me in Mecca. He brought his young son with him, who was 11 years old. And he put him in a Quranic school while studying in regular school, and after 3 years' time he had memorized the whole Quran from cover to cover. So it is something which is attainable by anyone who puts their mind to it. You have people, for example, like Hassan Tarabi, who is a figure, Islamic figure in Mecca. I remember meeting him, and he telling me that in his mid-thirties, when he had been imprisoned, he had time and he sat down and memorized, in the course of 2 years, memorized the whole Quran from cover to cover. So it's not even limited by age. You know, if a person sets their mind to it, Allah, God has put in the Quran a quality which allows it to be memorized very easily. What I'm saying is that if you go around the world and try to find a Christian who has memorized the whole New Testament, you're not going to find one. I'm not saying that you may not find some individuals who have what they call a photographic mind, photographic memory. They open any book, flip through the pages, and they can repeat for you whatever is on the pages. That is something which is exceptional. These hundreds of thousands are memorizing the Quran. These are not people who have this special quality. This is anybody who puts their mind to it can do it. This is one of the ways in which the Quran was preserved. So not only was it preserved in its written form, but it's also preserved in the hearts of the believers. And furthermore, God has put in the Quran certain scientific facts which have only been revealed, you know, with modern science. As time passes, man, with his modern science, is able to understand some of the verses of the Quran in a way which could not possibly have been understood before. Descriptions of the development, the stages of the embryo, are so minute. One of the leading embryologists in the world, Dr. Keith Moore, you know, whose books on embryology are studied in, you know, many of the universities around the world, he had written, you know, when he had given a history of the study of embryology, and he gave the example, the medieval concept of what the sperm was, you know, it had a little man inside of the sperm, you know, this is how they thought the sperm looked like. And he had talked, you know, about it was only until modern times that they were able to understand the actual structure and evolution and development of the embryo. He was invited to a conference and given some verses from the Quran which describe the stages by through which the human being evolves, and asked to give his comment as an embryologist. And he was so taken by it that the latest edition of his book on embryology, he has included this section in there. What he had not previously known, he pointed out how there is a description in there of the embryo at one stage of looking like chewed flesh. And when looking back at the stages of the development of the embryo, sure enough, there is a stage where it has certain impressions on it which look like if you put, you know, a piece of clay in your mouth and chew on it, it has these impressions. And so he's included this in, and this is something which could only be observed under a microscope. And there are a number of other scientific facts which have been spoken about by the Quran, which are only now, you know, being recognized by modern science. And this is further evidence of the divine origin of the Quran, that a human being, sure, and a person may say, well, if you go back to the ancient Greeks, we find Aristotle and certain others made certain predictions about atomic structure and different things, which later on science proved to be true. However, if we take this prediction of some of these ancient philosophers, etc., and we add to it the number of other statements that they made which are totally incorrect and proven totally false, we find that the incorrect statements far outweigh the few guesses which turned out to be true. Whereas when we go to the Quran, fact after fact after fact is consistent. This is not the way of a person who guesses. These are part of the science. And this is what led a French doctor by the name of Maurice Bocaille, who studied Arabic to get a better understanding of the Arabic text, studied the Quran, and was so impressed that he became a Muslim. He wrote a book, actually before becoming Muslim, he wrote a book called The Bible, the Quran, and Science. If you'd like to get more insight into this study, you know, I think they have copies available in the center here, you may be able to borrow it and read on it. You will see he has made a comparative study, you know, showing how time and time again within the Bible, because it is human writings and not divine in much of it, not in all of it, in much of it, it's human writings, you find a number of statements made which are contradictory to modern science, what modern science knows to be fact. Whereas comparing it to the Quran, we find what is known to be fact is in no way contradictory to what is in the Quran. Any other questions or comments?
Sir, you have to discuss more about the woman. The Muslim is allowed to marry more than four wives.
No. A maximum.
Not more than four wives.
A maximum of four.
Hiram, basically, financially, or any other qualifications I make. I asked my first wife that I'm going to marry the girl of my sister. I have said, marry that girl without causing my first wife.
Yes. You do not have to ask the consent of your first wife. This is a right given to you by God for the benefit of the society. However, discussing it with your first wife, you know, bringing her to understand it and, you know, to be able to accept it is better for the harmony of your relationship. Now, otherwise, you might be marrying a second wife and ending up being murdered in the bed of your first wife, right? Okay? So, you know, for harmony's sake, it is better to discuss and, you know, and come to some mutual agreement, you know, before undertaking that. But you really do not have to seek her permission. It is your right, as long as you're able to fulfill those requirements, you know, of financial, being able to maintain her in the same level as you maintain your first wife, you know, and fulfill all of the responsibilities without neglecting your first wife. Okay.
Like this flying part,
because as you know that there are numbers of religions nowadays also. And there are some many, many denominations, even just Christian, there are so many. So would you just like to make your point where a person can determine that he is really following the right thing that he is practicing?
Well,
I mean, how can a person, a Christian or a Buddhist or a Hindu, determine that he is on the right way or he is not?
Well, I would say that, one, for a person to determine the right path, he or she has to approach research with an open mind. Because if we are to approach it from an emotional point of view, then we are going to look at everything else critically and we will not get to the truth. We were born into circumstances which were not of our choosing. We did not choose to be born in whatever families we were born in, following whatever religion we were following. This was the destiny of God. But when we come to finding the religion of God and worshipping God, we have to be certain that the way that we're following is in fact the correct way. So we have to approach it with the intelligence which God has given us. We have to open our minds up and look at the evidence presented by each of the religions. Because they all can't be right. Because they all claim that each one is the only one. If they all said, it's okay, no matter what you follow, everything's right, then there's no problem. We could just go along with whatever we found ourselves in. But each one says, our way is the only way. So now if each is saying our way is the only way, it's not possible that they all could be right. There has to be right and wrong. So then we have to go now in and look at what are the basic concepts. And the starting point really is God. We need to go to see who is God in the different religions. How is God described? Our intelligence will tell us, ultimately, when we see the explanations given in the different religions, our intelligence will tell us what is God and what is not God. A Hindu who thinks, when you bring him to the reality of what he worships, the main object of worship, Shiva, is represented by what is called